Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
My guest today is Josh Sterling. Josh is a partner at Jones Day, a former senior regulator himself. Josh was previously the director of the CFTC's Market Participants Division. We're going to talk today about his work at the CFTC, why he joined, how the financial collapse in 2008 impacted the work he did at the CFTC, and his thinking today. We'll also talk in detail about the CFTC and crypto. We'll also talk about an interesting book that he's read that I wanted to highlight around the price of time, which is an interesting topic, and the work he does today for clients regarding CFTC regulations and procedures. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. All right, everyone. I am here with Josh Sterling. Josh, thanks for joining me today. Really looking forward to this episode.
No, it's my great pleasure to be here, Jacob. Thanks.
I thought we'd start with your Genesis block. And the idea here is to learn a bit more about your introduction to Bitcoin, what you were doing at the time, what your first impression was. Is there a story there?
Oh, most definitely. So I think probably for most listeners of this podcast, I'd be someone who came to it pretty late. I had to give a presentation to my law firm about blockchain technology and Bitcoin in, golly, that must have been 2018. And I have to confess, at that point, I didn't know much about it other than what I would read like in The Economist or something. And so I learned a lot then, and I sort of put it to the side. And then I got into government and its CFTC. And the CFTC had this unit set up by Chairman Giancarlo, who preceded us there, the crypto dad, great guy, called Lab CFTC, which, you know, it wasn't a sandbox. It was a place people could come in and talk about their ideas. And from the jump, started learning about Bitcoin, Ethereum, that network, started learning about the beginnings of stable coins and even DAOs. You know, we were talking to DAOs at that point as well. So it sort of came on all of a sudden and quickly. And then coming out of government, I should say, towards the very end of our tenure, I got pretty involved in what ultimately became the commission's action against BitMEX, which was a huge crypto platform. There was a parallel criminal case as well. So that was pretty intense. So I got a crash course in about 2 years in government on it.
And I can imagine it would be easy to be jaded by a technology like this when you are introduced to it in what could be a negative way with a platform that's going through troubles like BitMEX was at the time. But is there, sure. What was your initial impression? Did you see it as something that would stick around for the future?
Yeah, no, I understand the appeal of it. And, you know, look, there's bad actors in everything. I mean, cars are one of the greatest inventions of all time. There are really bad car companies. You don't hate cars, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty agnostic about what things are. I wasn't government, you know. Markets aren't, you know, an expression of human freedom. They're the basis of it. And I think that free markets are important. And I thought it was important for free market to develop in these products. You know, we try to develop some principles. You know, my boss at the agency, Chairman Tarbert, was very focused on principles-based regulation. And I continue to believe that's the way to go. And so we try to come up with rules of the road to let it go. I mean, the dumbest thing you can do in any position of power is think that you have all the answers. You don't. You find yourself sitting in a room of people who all agree with you more often than not. That's a very dangerous thing unless you're somewhat self-aware. And you're like, well, I don't know. Did anyone talk to anybody else about this? Not in government. So I said, you know, let's meet with people and I might think there's something to it or not, but that doesn't really matter. What they're looking for from us are principles, and we can only learn what principles make sense if we talk to as many of these people as possible. And so that's how I looked at it. Hey, let's have an open mind. I continue to have it. I, you know, obviously represent a number of crypto companies and have taken exception since I've been out of government with the way at least some government agencies have treated crypto, which is slow walking them to an early death or trying to do it. It's not the way to govern, but that's, you know, probably a libertarian podcast or something I'll do later.
Can we chat about the BitMEX case for a second? I'd love if you could give people who maybe are familiar but could use a refresher on what happened there and why in the end they were ordered to pay, I think it was $100 million. Was that the final amount?
Yeah, it was a substantial penalty. It was around that or just shy of it. So our involvement with BitMEX came about because we had already by that time as an agency taken the view that certain tokens were commodities. And that's, you know, commodity is the first word of CFTC. Almost everything in the world is a commodity. So, okay, so Bitcoin is a commodity. Ether is a commodity. You know, other tokens could be, we'll see, be securities or not. But they're commodities. It makes sense. And so if you're transacting in them and you're doing it in a way that violates some rules, you're in trouble. And it's one thing to buy and sell Bitcoin and Ethereum, Ether, excuse me, on a spot basis. It's another one to offer it to retail traders and help them finance it or give them a loan to buy it or let them trade that on margin. When you do that, then the CFTC has even more regulatory authority. And, you know, there'd been a lot of commentary in the popular press I was aware of going into the case where the at least some of the founders of BitMEX were talking about what was going on and why they might have chosen to set up in the Seychelles as opposed to other countries because it's cheaper to bribe people there than in America. You read that and you're like, all right, these people are making statements. Boy, aren't they. But, you know, you can say stuff. It's, that's still legal, I think, to say things. But we were presented with information about potentially illicit activity that may have transpired on the platform. And I won't get into all of that. I think it's all in the charging documents. And the way the agency works is, particularly on a big case, you have the Division of Enforcement. They're the cops. Then you have my division, which is one of the policymaking divisions. We have oversight for, you know, the intermediaries, the brokers and the dealers and the advisors and commodities. And part of the theory of the case enforcement wanted to bring was, well, aren't they acting a bit like a broker for these trades that really are derivatives? If so, they needed a license to do that. It's a futures commission merchant, an FCM, and they didn't have one. And you know what? If they were supposed to have that license because they were an FCM, well, guess what? FCMs have anti-money laundering obligations under U.S. law. And so there was a question about the theory of the case. Could we charge them with not being a broker? And we looked at that pretty hard. We thought, you know, look, it seems like it could be a close question, but it's definitely colorable, more likely than not, is what I remember of it. And so it was charged, and, you know, they wound up settling with CFTC and I think with FinCEN for that amount of money, around $100 million, I think you're right. And I thought it was a fairly aggressive charge. Well, fast forward, you see it in almost every case against the platform these days. So that's what I remember most about it. We were really kind of, I wouldn't say pushing the envelope, but helping enforcement and the agency ultimately be aggressive because they felt strongly, and as did DOJ, that there was credible evidence of illegal activity. And they wanted to, you know, throw the proverbial book at them. And I think that they did. So that's what I recall of it. But it didn't make me think any less of crypto. It just made me think there's a company that's just maybe gotten a little out of hand, it would seem.
Right. Yeah. It's important to separate even something like the collapse of the banks in 2008. We didn't start blaming money itself. Money was just something that they used as part of their business and would transact with. So, yeah, no, I think that's a great point. So let's just take a step back and talk about you joining the CFTC. Why join public service? How does something like that come about? Because that wasn't the beginning of your career either. You were a seasoned vet in the derivative space at that point.
Yeah, I was in my early 40s, I guess. And I was working as a partner in a law firm. Things were cool. And I happened to see that one of my law school classmates, who I had followed his career, I knew him in law school, I met him on the first day, Heath Tarbert, had been, you know, getting into the middle of the Trump administration, nominated to be CFTC chairman. And so I sent a joking email to one of my partners. I said, oh, ha, maybe I should try to be a division director. And he wrote me back. He's like, are you serious? Because I know some people that are putting together a list. And I said, oh, well, sure, why not? I like Heath. All right. And I went over there and ultimately was able to interview with Heath in his very fancy official Treasury Department office. CFTC is not nearly as nice as the Treasury Department. It doesn't have to be. But ultimately, it came down to someone that I knew well when we were both young calling me and offering me an opportunity to help my country. And, you know, I'm no hero. I wasn't in the military or anything or in harm's way, like my wife. She's a veteran. But I said, you know, I'm being asked to help my country. And I believe in, you know, free markets and limited governments. You know, I'm a Republican. And I said, I don't want to be the guy that, when asked to help his country, said no. Because I got kids, you know, and they're going to want to know about me and tell people about me someday, maybe. And so I said, I should probably do this. And that's why I did it. I did it because I thought I could help out. I thought I could help the country in the way that I best could, given what I'd spend my life working on to date.
And when you started there and thinking back at your time there, how did the financial collapse in 2008 play a role in your thinking in the regulation? I'd just be curious to hear your thoughts on how that shaped the thinking around intermediaries, around the financial system, systemic risk, things like that, coming from the angle of the CFTC, or obviously in your particular capacity.
Yeah. Well, you know, with respect to derivatives, I remember during the financial crisis, I was actually at a meeting at a major bank the day that the reserve fund broke the buck. And that was a pretty weird day to be, you know, on Wall Street. It's very quiet. Some lines at ATMs with people taking out big wads of cash. You know, and I remember Alan Greenspan after that saying that derivatives were weapons of financial mass destruction. And I thought that was one of the clearest things he's ever said, but also one of the most wrong things he ever said. Financial instruments and the users of them are not the problem. The problem are sort of the surrounding conditions in the market that give rise to their use. And there you had the worst combination of private risk-taking with public accountability in the form of the mortgage industry and, frankly, tax policies and all other sorts of things that conspired. And then, you know, a total seeming lack of underwriting discipline. Let's just call it for mortgages and move on, shall we? So there's a confluence of events, but that was complexity. You can't predict when complex systems are going to collapse. You just have to appreciate that the more complex they get, they will. At some point, have some disruptions. And you got to figure out what to do. And you got to figure out what to do in a way that's real simple. So I know that, you know, those lessons, or those thoughts were in my mind. And I'm not special. I mean, there were 200 and some other million Americans experienced the financial crisis. So no one's special for experiencing that, although some of our officials like to act like they are. I think that's foolish. But in any event, so when we got into COVID and the decision to kind of shut down the world economy, well, it's like my wife was in the Navy and you couldn't stop that aircraft carrier on a dime if you had to. And so I think the financial markets needed to keep moving, but they couldn't. They were missing some fuel. And that fuel was money, and money was literally being sucked out of the markets. Everybody wanted dollars. Nobody even wanted treasury so much for a period of time. So you had treasury markets going haywire. It was affecting the treasury futures markets. And you also had at one point the price of oil going negative. You had to give someone money to take your oil. That's not unprecedented, but it's unusual and disturbing. So all this stuff's going on. You got to figure out what the biggest and most important levers are to pull. And you got to know what to watch out for. You know that you need to watch out for things. And so two things I can really think of to wrap this up are two different events. One is I got a call from someone at a large bank. You know, the day, I think it was on a Sunday, the governor and the mayor of New York said that everything was being shut down. And this person called me and said, look, Asian markets are opening tonight. We need, you know, our traders are going to have to work from home and they can't record. You got to record your lines, you know, if you're a broker or a dealer. They can't record their calls or necessarily log all their emails or whatever from home. Like, what should we do? And I said to myself, it wasn't a hard decision. It's like, well, good God, I mean, trade. To have rules to follow, the rules govern markets, we have to have markets to begin with. So please trade. We'll worry about it later. You know, just go trade. Very simple. Go trade. That's easy. And that was just me talking to one bank. I didn't, you know, whatever. The second thing was I didn't know what was going to come up, but things come up. And so every day, twice a day, for 4 months, my team called every registered broker and every registered dealer that handled customer funds, and they asked two questions morning and night. Do you have the money, and can you trade? If the answer to one of those questions was no, I would tell the chairman. If the answer to both those questions was no, we would call the White House. We did call the White House once. So I didn't know what the hell to look for. I just knew to ask. And that's really what you got to do, and then you got to react. And so that's a very long way of saying that 2008 was a big problem. 2020, you know, the economies were bigger, but, you know, there was a bit of a script that one could follow, and the markets proved to be resilient. But I think being watchful and not assuming you know everything really helps.
Yeah, being willing to say, I want to learn more, and asking questions and getting data. And even, I love your approach too about, we spoke to them every day and we asked them questions consistently. And that gave us the data to make better decisions and to pass it along as we needed to.
Yeah. I mean, the key is to get it right. You don't need to be right. You just need to get it right. And I always said, you know, I still today with these young associates, you know, if you got an idea and it's better, we're going to use it. So speak up.
Yeah. Yeah. So shifting a bit to Web3, given, you know, the state of our financial system and how we've seen a tendency towards centralization with many of the banks, how do you see, given the work that you've done, and where does something like a Web3, a democratization of the financial system, is that something that's realistic? Do you see that as something, as a possibility?
Yeah. So I think in its purest form, as explained to me once, Web3 is about sort of owning your information on the web or whatever distributed system of information and knowledge there is. And I understand that, and it makes a lot of sense. I don't think we're anywhere near that actually happening. I try to have a decent finger on the pulse of things and understand what's going on. I'm not sure that's quite where we're at. I think it's a great idea. You know, obviously there are a lot of companies that deliver wonderful services through, you know, I guess Web 1 or Web 2 based applications. And they make a lot of money off of our information. And it isn't a good argument that they should. I mean, I can't tell you the last time I was at a big box store because I just order stuff on Amazon. Thank you, Mr. Bezos. It's not all bad, right? Yeah. But there's definitely a case for Web3. And I also think the more you get into less rule of law regimes, boy, is there a strong case for Web3. Being able to privately transact and privately own your own financial security and potentially assets that have monetary value that are not subject to hyperinflation or confiscation. I think that's really important. And when we talked to the Libra and DM folks when I was in government, I thought their quest was noble. It just seemed really hard and it didn't work out. So I think that's really important, you know, in the developing world, particularly. In more advanced financial systems, I think it's hard. The bottom line is they're going to want things to be permissioned and they're going to want things to be centralized because you know where things are. You can point at them. You can touch them. You can regulate them. And there's a whole ecosystem. God knows I live in the middle of it in Washington, D.C., where it's like we've got the regulators. You've got the consultants. You've got the lawyers. You've got the accountants. We all have our roles, right? And, you know, not to be cynical about it, but I think it's really hard to give up control. And frankly, given the size of our economies and just the size of the pieces moving around in it, I think centralization is going to be very important. I think that's true. If you look at what could be the most promising digital asset growth opportunity out there, it would be stable coins. I think there's every sense that the stablecoin industry wants legislation, it wants regulation. You're going to regulate a central thing, you know. And so I think it's going to be very hard to have sort of a pure decentralization. But I do think that same technology can make things work better and faster and more reliably. And there's always a risk that you're going to lose that single authentic thing that's the record of something of value. And if you're in a more decentralized system, you know, it might be easier to safeguard that because of the, you know, the public validation process and the permanence of it. I really think that there's opportunities to take care of that or to take advantage of that. I don't know because I'm not sitting in government policymaking meetings and I don't work inside a bank or a clearinghouse or anything. But I'd like to think that the people are really thinking about how they can use technology like that. I hope we haven't skipped all of that and just moved on to being excited about AI, you know?
It's the newest kid on the block there. But one thing I want to talk to you about, why the CFTC should regulate crypto, what aspect of this digital economy it makes sense to regulate. Because I think we often take for granted, regardless of whether or not things are securities, the whole point of the classification is to group them into a bucket that a regulator would have jurisdiction over. And so when you think of the CFTC, where do you see them playing a role in the future of digital assets?
Yeah. You know, I can't help myself. I will say, I think it's great we have spot Bitcoin ETFs. We should have them, you know. The government is not supposed to regulate financial products for safety. It's a disclosure-based regime. And it really says something about the SEC, which when you have a chairman who goes from being, you know, Dr. No to looking like Kevin Bacon at the end of Animal House trying to stop this crowd, it's not a great look, but, you know, you own it, good, bad, warts and all. So I really think for me on crypto, it's going to now come down to, like, what's happened has happened. I think the answer should be just pick one of them. Just pick one regulator to regulate crypto. If you divide it, it's going to be a disaster. 20-some years ago, Congress passed a law that, among other things, was the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. It passed in 2000. That's how old I am. I was in law school. And it said, okay, great. The SEC and the CFTC are going to regulate something called security futures products, which principally included single stock futures. And CFTC is going to do this, and SEC is going to do that, and they're both going to talk and be happy. Absolutely not. I mean, as late as 2019, many people's Thanksgiving weekends at the CFTC were ruined because there was some springing jurisdictional fight with the SEC over somebody's security futures product. And those were not pleasant conversations. Don't do that. You know, with Dodd-Frank in 2008, all right, CFTC's got most of the swaps, SEC's got some. SEC hasn't even finished writing the rules yet. And the rules are kind of different. And there's no reason for that. So pick one. I think right now, size of crypto market's down. A lot of cryptos don't really seem at all like investment contracts. They just don't. I don't know that the SEC is the best place to regulate it, particularly if the principal purpose of the crypto is it's not going to be capital raising in the traditional sense. So if you're going to say a market regulator has to do it, between the two, I'd say CFTC. And I'm not saying that, you know, SEC's done an absolutely terrible job and the CFTC's been great. I think they've both had some misses and they both had some hits. I just think the CFTC is better able to do it because it's a more principles-based regulator. And it's a regulator that focuses on assets already, that the point of them is to have strong markets to discover prices. And you want to know the price of Bitcoin, the price of Ether, the type of price of Solana, whatever. SEC has a little bit more of an investor protection focus in the sense of, this is a stock, this is a bond, it's an asset, right? And it's a financial asset, it's income producing, gives ownership rights, or it's a debt contract. And I just think that creates a whole different mindset. So I just think from a philosophical point of view, the CFTC might be a better home. But whoever is going to do it, I think Congress really needs to say with a clear voice exactly what it is they're going to do.
Just based on that, there is a difference between the regulation, the CFTC and the SEC, which is much more disclosure based, put the investors on level playing field, versus the CFTC, which from my understanding is more price discovery and making sure everyone has the same sort of baseline understanding of this certain commodity or asset. And digital assets are interesting in that they could still be impacted after initial creation by that initial party, that initial creator.
Right.
While at the same time taking many of the forms of a more traditional asset or commodity like we think of today. And so there almost needs to be some sort of middle ground. And I guess when you're saying the CFTC could be the regulator, there would potentially be a new arm of the CFTC to handle this sort of new area? Or do you think existing the way it is today, it could be accommodated?
Well, you could reorganize the agency. What I would not do is create a third agency. Then you're going to have what I call the CFPB problem. And that's a huge problem. I don't care what you think, what political persuasion you might be. The CFPB is a huge problem. It really can stifle financial innovation. It can really harm banks. It can harm fintechs. It's not good. So I would not say create a third agency. But what you could do is, you know, have a statute that says, you know, the agency shall create XYZ division. It will do these things. It will have these authorities. And so you wouldn't have the agency doing it on its own accord. And, you know, look, I think I will say this. In terms of the SEC, if there's a company out there, fintech or TradFi or just a corporate, that wants to raise money and do sort of like a digitally native securities offering, yeah, the SEC should absolutely. That could mean for a DeFi or something, you're doing an initial token launch. Maybe those are securities and, hey, you've got to go do a S1 registration statement. It doesn't matter that they're digitized, right? But when they turn into something else, they're converted into something else, it ought to be possible for them not to be, you know, a securities offering. Because you're past the fundraising stage, you've got a business, this token has some other utility value to it, it's something else. Or maybe those tokens retire or there's some exchange mechanism in the smart contract. There's got to be a way to do it to where you don't make the CFTC become a securities regulator. If someone's actually raising with tokenized securities, go do it. It's very clear what that is. Otherwise, if you're operating a market for trading tokens, if you're a liquidity provider in a market, you have to follow these rules and do these things. And because it's market-based, CFTC is going to be all over.
It's a thorny problem where it's interesting, though, because if you take the analogy of paper, right, you can write a stock certificate on paper. You could write a bond. Like, there's so much you can do, an interest note. It shouldn't be the asset itself that determines, you know, just the fact that it's a digital asset shouldn't make it that much more difficult. But even just when you're speaking there, I'm thinking, well, it really is hard to distinguish whether or not something is a security or not.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, these things are very easy to say, but I will say when you're trying to put it into law, and I'm no legislative drafter, the law should be as short as possible and concise as possible, as clear as possible. It should leave as little as possible to the agencies to futz around with. I think it should be pretty tight. I think that would require, you know, and I've certainly had occasion to speak with casually, you know, with people on the staffs in the House, Financial Services, Senate, Ag, and others that oversee these agencies. And they are true public servants. They work hard. They don't make a super ton of money. And they're really trying to do the right thing. And it is quite hard. Everyone's at the table. It's a democratic process trying to come to the right answer. But I think capital raising and, you know, asset trading can be two different things, and they can be regulated as two different things. But I think it's also important for the people seeking to issue tokens to be very clear about what it is they really want. You know, and by the way, right now, you kind of default in the commodities land if you have a digital asset and it's trading back and forth, because although that's just physical asset trading in a spot market, the CFTC has anti-fraud jurisdiction over physical, you know, just spot markets and physical commodities. So like you're backed into it. So, you know, it's almost like you'd say, all right, well, again, it goes back to, we got to pick a regulator. Let's pick one and try to make the best analogies you can to substantiate that. I will say, though, I think the SEC has totally disqualified itself as an agency from being capable of handling financial innovation. I think it's appalling how it's gone on the last 3 years, and it should never be repeated. And, you know, I would hope that in any subsequent administration, a hard look is taken at the functions of the SEC. They're dramatically limited, and they are aggressively overseen by Congress, because it's just gotten way out of hand. It's not helpful to anybody.
Yeah. And so if you were, Josh, if you were teaching a course and you had to map out like one or two reasons or things to do differently based on what's happened over the past couple of years with the SEC, what would be some discussions points that you'd bring up?
Yeah. I think there's two things. One, I think the SEC needs to get back to the fundamental focus when it's regulating capital markets for regulating a disclosure-based regime. and not a merit-based regime. You shouldn't care what a company sells. You shouldn't care who the CEO is, unless it's some crook or something, obviously. The law ought to be such that you're really focused on, do they meet the requirements of the form to register their securities and sell them? And there's a great speech, it's still up on the SEC website last time I checked. It's from like 1934 or 35 or something, where a commissioner, newly created agency, sort of said, this is what we're doing. You have to say what the registration form says, and if you don't, we issue a stop order. You can't sell your stock. You can't sell your bonds. Great. That's what we need. That's a huge improvement from what became before. It's gotten much more complicated since then. I think focusing on that's really good. The second thing I would say is there's a hell of a lot of power, discretion in enforcement, prosecution. The power to prosecute is the power to destroy. I think that you should really focus enforcement powers on honest to God cases where individual investors are being screwed. I think that's where most of the focus should be. Right. Look, banks didn't stop their traders from using their personal phones. Okay. Somebody didn't have enough capital. Someone didn't report their swaps trades correctly. Okay, I understand that you broke the law. But quit looking for a rich seam of cases where there's just a bunch of offenses so that you can build up a rap sheet. I understand the incentives to do that. Governments make things. They make cases. They're there to bring cases. But bring cases where you're going to do the most amount of good for the public you're there to protect. So go after the fraud. I mean, they do, but go after it even more. Fraudsters and commodity side, it always seems to be foreign exchange trading or precious metals. Just seems to be by the percentages. In the SEC, there's always these retirement scams or reverse mortgage scams or other such scams. Scams of targeting, you know, military bases overseas. Really focus on that. Do some good. Get some restitution.
I think it's a principles approach, like you alluded to, rather than just, this is the rule book, we're blindly following the rules, it doesn't matter what this context, what the situation, if we think they broke the rules, we're going to go after them. And it's even been interesting for me over the past few years, being so involved in this industry, seeing how Canada's regulated exchanges and platforms compared to the SEC. And there's so many other approaches than just looking at someone saying, we don't like what you're doing, we don't agree with it, we're going to go after you, and we're not going to give you any rules. Like, it's, I don't know how they forget. Their job is to protect the public and work with companies.
I agree. I also feel like, you know, there is definitely a role for civil enforcement of these laws. And I know when I was in government, if we had evidence indicating that a regulated entity we oversaw might have broken the rules. I mean, we had no choice but to tell enforcement about it. We can't solve that problem. We have information. We pass along. They'll exercise their judgment on what to do about it. So I understand all that. Let us not forget that we have criminal authorities. You know, the United States attorneys. We have state attorneys general. They have serious powers to address serious problems, and they do. And so we can't forget that in thinking about perhaps what the proper scope of civil enforcement is, especially against corporates.
Two other questions for you, Josh. The first was about reading material. And I was going through doing some research on things you've published. And one book you mentioned was The Price of Time, The Real Story of Interest by Edward Chancellor, which is a history of interest from one of the world's leading financial writers. It explains sort of our global financial position and how we got here. I'd love if you could describe what you took away from the book and if you recommend it for people.
Yeah, you know, I've always been interested in markets. And, you know, there are just some things that are, there's age old about markets. And I always am curious about how far back that stuff goes. And so that book was really interesting about the price of time, which is basically what interest is by one definition. And so it was very fascinating to learn about that. And the most interesting thing about that book is there's a decent discussion there about archaeological evidence indicating that borrowing might have preceded bartering in some economies. So I just thought that was fascinating. And also to think about, you know, what borrowing enables you to do. I mean, it enables you to bring forward into the present things you couldn't do till much later, just based on how assets and value are currently allocated. And you can totally flip that by borrowing against the future. And so I just, debt is complex. And reading a book that provided sort of some linear ways of thinking about it was really valuable. And, you know, that's not a hard academic piece of literature. There's no sigma notation. So for yo-yos like me, it was really good. I guess I enjoy reading, you know, pop finance books. And that's a darn good one.
I find the history around the world of finance to be so interesting as well, because especially in the crypto space, we see all these mistakes that happened over hundreds of years condensed into a 13, 14 year period by Yes. people who are learning them for themselves and really experimenting and pushing the needle. But history repeats itself. And if it didn't work 300 years ago, it's probably not going to work today. And so I love finding books like this about the history. So I'll add that to the show notes below for everybody listening.
Fantastic.
The one last question for you, Josh, was just advice. Is there any advice you were given early in your career that has shaped who you have become or that you think of often and really made a big difference?
Yeah. So there's two things. I learned them both as an associate at the Cleary Gottlieb law firm where I started my career. And one was great. I actually happened when I was a summer associate. We all went up to the New York office to hear a talk. And you're up there, and I hadn't been to New York much as a kid, you know, and really neat, really kind of fun. And you're sitting there listening to this partner explain to you what the expectations are for young associates. And he said, we have one simple rule here at the firm. All we ask is that when it leaves your desk, it's perfect. And an uncomfortable silence followed. But you knew that was the standard. And nothing's ever going to be perfect, but you're sure as shoot going to try. And I always think about that, really, to anything. The second one was another partner. And I'm so old, these partners were probably practicing law in the 60s. So that's ancient history for you and many listeners, I'm sure. This fellow was telling me about how he got put on a plane as a young lawyer to fly to the Congo to help resolve a mining dispute. He was like a third year associate out of Harvard Law School or something. And they'd given him, you know, this huge pack of papers to read on the flight over. And of course he read them, and he's a smart guy. But he said, you know, what dawned on me about halfway over the Atlantic was that all I needed to do was ask these people, what's really going on here? And you keep asking essentially that same question until you understand. And once you understand, you can help. And boy, that really helps a lot. You know, I talk to traders, I talk to founders of companies, whatever. And you don't understand really much of what they're doing, but you come to understand it by asking questions. What's going on here? Why is this happening? Then you know how you can help once you understand. So you got to be inclined to ask questions. Proceed from a position of ignorance, which for someone like me is pretty easy. Ask anyone I work with. And I just think that's what to do. You know, try to be perfect and make sure you know what you're doing before you start trying to help.
Well, look, Josh, I think those are great. I really enjoyed it. And I think, too, just thinking about the regulators and the CFTC and the role that the financial market plays, it's going to be a massive one when it comes to regulation, and crypto will have a big impact. What it looks like, it's hard to say at this point, but really appreciate the work you do. And for those who are interested in learning more, I'll put a link in the show notes below that they can find your page and reach out. Is the best way to contact you through email?
Yeah, that'd be great. I'm always happy to talk to anybody who has an interest in financial markets or the law, what have you. So I'm always happy to. When I was younger, people sure were generous with their time with me. So I'm very happy to do the same. And thank you, Jacob. This is a great podcast, and you do a great job. And I'm a huge fan. So thank you so much.